Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a drug testing conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Drug testing, as in peeing in a cup and sending it to the lab to check for drugs. One of the jokes I fondly remember from medical school, specifically while studying urology, was, did you hear about the nitwit who spent all night studying for his urine test? No, but did he pass? Okay, so maybe there's a reason I'm a doctor and not a comedian. Workplace drug testing is meant to promote safety. Employees who know that they will be regularly screened for drugs are less likely to use drugs while at work. I think most people would agree that they don't want their pilot or surgeon to work while under the influence of drugs. Drug testing can occur as pre-employment. This is an open book test that allows you to take before getting the job. Drug testing can occur randomly. Pilots are subject to a urine test without notification before boarding a flight. And drug testing can occur for cause after an accident or adverse event. Employers benefit from workplace drug tests with increased safety, decreased liability, and saving the company money. Some people do not like drug testing. They say it violates employee privacy. There are arguments whether drug testing is too expensive or actually saves money and helps people get into addiction treatment. When did this whole drug testing business get started? Many policies occur after a sentinel event. Drug testing started with an executive order under President Ronald Reagan after a serious accident on the aircraft carrier USS Nimitz in 1981 that killed 14 crew members and injured 45 others. Autopsies showed that the pilot had high doses of a decongestant. An autopsy of 7 out of 14 crew tested positive for marijuana. President Reagan created a no-tolerance policy for drugs for federal employees in 1986, right after this incident. To learn more about drug testing, I reach out to the director of the federal agencies that oversees the federal regulation for drug testing, Ronald Flegel. Ronald Flegel is a forensic toxicologist and director of the Division of Workplace Program under SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. He's been doing that since 2012. Before joining SAMHSA, he worked for Quest Diagnostic Laboratory as a technical scientist. To learn more about Ronald Flegel and SAMHSA's Division of Workplace Programs, check out the High Truths show notes. Ronald Flegel, welcome to High Truths.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for allowing me to be here with you today.
I'm very excited to have you back, see you again. I'm very thankful to you. I met you when I was working at ONDCP and learned a lot about drug testing, how it happens, why it happens, and very excited to have you share that knowledge with our audience.
Thank you.
And so I thought we'd start out with a little background. You are a forensic toxicologist. What is that and why did you want to be one?
Well, forensic toxicologist is really, I mean, someone that looks at all different kinds of a puzzle, in a sense, I think, and puts it all together. We're in a little bit different as far as forensic toxicology and what we do a lot of the policy side as well as the drug testing side or the testing side within the federal agencies as well as within SAMHSA. So I myself was initially, I started at Johns Hopkins Hospital in emergency toxicology. And then from then I expanded out. I left Johns Hopkins. I went to Quest Diagnostics as one of the managers there on the screening in the screening department. Learned a lot there in the regulated drug testing sector. And then in 2004, I left Quest Diagnostics, went to the Walch Group. And then later on in that same year, I also went to, was hired by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, as the forensic toxicologist in that division. From that point, I became the CORE, which is a contracting officer representative over the National Laboratory Certification Program. And then I, in 2012, became director of Division of Workplace Programs. So my whole career has been around forensic toxicology, the testing policy side, as well as a number of other things.
Is there a difference between forensic toxicology and just toxicology? Toxicology is like drug testing. What about various drugs, not just illegal drugs, right? We could get Tylenol levels and aspirin levels. But what about forensic?
So forensic toxicology is more of what I would say a chain of custody. It's the possession of a sample that goes through legal proceedings. Whereas toxicology could be you're testing environmental contaminants. So there's a huge difference, I think, between the toxicology side of all environmental testing, different testing regarding that, and the forensic testing, which really is a legal matter of how you have that specimen, what specimens tested, et cetera.
Interesting. So SAMHSA deals with mental health and substance use. Is it strange that they have a program on drug testing and forensic toxicologists as part of that organization?
No, I really think, I mean, the Division of Workplace Programs is really one of the largest prevention programs within SAMHSA. We're a deterrent program on the HHS side. So we look at testing as a deterrence from using illicit substances or substance use. So there's other federal agencies, and I'll just mention a few. One is, for instance, Department of Transportation, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Department of Defense. They all do drug testing, but it's a little bit different in the sense that, for instance, Nuclear Regulatory Commission has a fitness for duty. So it's being fit, not using illicit substances or impairing substances when you're on the work site. Again, SAMHSA or HHS, and where we sit under the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention, is actually a deterrent program. And I'll just mention also that Department of Transportation is actually what I would call a semi-fitness for duty, meaning they have a clinical component to it where they do blood pressure, eye exams, et cetera, that is also part of the licensee, for instance, under FMCSA to get your CDL.
So wait, we don't know what those acronyms mean. Tell us what that means.
CDL is your license to drive, for instance, a truck. FMCSA is Federal Motor Carrier. So it's anyone that drives a large truck, in a sense. So, and then Department of Defense, of course, DOD, has a readiness program where they test to make sure military is ready. And that would be for all four branches. So that's okay. So it's a very different program when it comes to whether it's fitness for duty or it's a deterrence. So it's how we look at the regulated drug testing sectors as a whole under the federal or federally regulated drug testing.
That's interesting because there is different philosophies. One is a deterrence of using drugs, like a lot of parents randomly test their children for drugs. They drug test at home, and that's a deterrence for them, right? We'd rather don't want to have that. And fitness for duty, you want your pilot at all times if they're ready to fly and be drug free and in with no, you know, optimize their capacity is same as for the military, right?
Right. And that is definitely a fitness for duty because, like you said, as far as an airline pilot, they are all tested under FAA. And it is if you're ready, you know, to fly a plane in the sense.
So they're not under Department of Transportation. That's another one.
Well, Department of Transportation has six different modes. One of those is FAA, Federal Aviation Administration. Other modes are FMCSA, as I mentioned, the trucking, there's pipeline, there's hazardous material. So there's six different modes that actually fall under Department of Transportation. Just as an interesting side, which I think is interesting, is Department of Homeland Security, DHS, actually falls under the federal testing. So that's all maritime testing, Coast Guard, TSA for transit authority. So all of those actually fall under the federally regulated sectors.
And do they each make different rules, like the rules for a truck driver is different than for a pilot?
So the rules, what governs really everything in the regulated drug testing sector is the mandatory guidelines. We have mandatory guidelines using urine, mandatory guidelines using oral fluid, and we've proposed mandatory guidelines using hair. I say that because we fall under the mandatory guidelines of the technical part and scientific side of having the regulations. Department of Transportation, or DOT, falls under 49 CFR Part 40. So that's their rule that falls under Department of Transportation. Nuclear Regulatory Commission falls under Part 26. So each of us have our own regulatory authority, but at the same time, all of the HHS certified laboratories do the testing for all federally regulated samples. So that's NRC, DOT, and some parts of DOD, or the civilian side of Department of Defense.
Interesting. All right. So the very different legal structures, but they come together all to the same lab. And that falls under what you are director of, which is the Division for Workplace Program. That's under SAMHSA. And what is that?
So Division of Workplace Program is really, it affects about 14 million people. And our authority falls under Executive Order 12564 and Public Law 100-71. We're required to oversee the National Laboratory Certification Program. And that's actually the entity that has the HHS certified labs when we go out and do the inspection. So that's one part of our program. The other part is called the Drug-Free Workplace Program, which is the acronym is DFWP. And that really is the policy side that falls under the executive branch agencies within the federal government. So we oversee that portion, and that's required in our regulatory authority is to oversee those two. We also have sort of a third part of our division, which looks at emerging issues. So any type of drug that's coming out or things that we look at in the future of what type of test or what type of drug we may want to look at as far as testing, that would fall under that third branch of our division in the Division of Workplace Programs.
Fascinating. Okay, so let's take those three. The laboratory certification program. Is that the same as where I go get my blood drawn for my physical, same type of standards? Is this different? Is this one lab for the nation, or how does it go?
So the labs in themselves, they have to be HHS certified, and that's Health and Human Service certified. So they fall specifically, it's required under our authority that the laboratories get HHS certified. So those labs are the only labs in the program that can test federal and federally regulated drug tests. So they have to be and are required to be certified. So it's very different in the sense of a lot of the laboratories around the United States, they test in what's called the non-regulated sector or the regulated sector. So in the non-regulated sector, they don't really aren't really required to have a certification to test those samples. They do fall under a lot of outside sources like CLIA, CAP, that's College of American Pathology, those type of testing. But our labs are specifically designed to test the regulated drug test, and we inspect them twice per year. And we have inspectors that go out to the laboratories again twice per year, and we send them proficiency testing samples four times per year. So they're very regulated. It's very tight restrictions as to what they do, how they test, what regulations they're required to test under, what cutoffs. There's a number of different things within those laboratories that we oversee around the scientific and technical part.
So those specimens are very accurate, as accurate as can be, because you're inspecting them so many times a year. And they also regulate the chain of custody?
Correct. We also do regulate the chain of custody form. That is a form that we put out from our agency. It's a chain, basically it's a chain of possession of when the sample is collected, the transport of that sample to the regulated laboratory. From that point, it's an internal chain where the sample moves within the laboratory, for instance, to the screening assay, then to confirmation or whatever other test it may have to include in that laboratory. So everything is done by chain of possession. So, and that's why I said earlier around the legal proceedings is it's all really around a chain of possession of that specimen that's collected.
Interesting. So actually, before I got the job at ONDCP, I had to give a urine sample, and I got to experience that whole process. And, you know, the lady followed me all the way to the bathroom. I was patted down, made sure there was had like no little cheating mecca. She didn't actually watch me pee. I was worried about that. But everything minus that, and I passed my test. All right. So that's the labs. And then the whole drug-free workplace program. Tell us about that.
Well, the drug-free workplace program was really, it's a comprehensive program that really addresses illicit drug use. It covers all federal employees in all 200 executive branch agencies. And these can also, some parts go into, like I said, Department of Transportation and Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but really the drug-free workplace program is for the executive branch agencies. And again, the program adheres to the policies, guidelines, authorities, and the regulations that we set. Our authority comes under Executive Order 12564, Public Law 100-71, as well as the mandatory guidelines for federal workplace drug testing, whether they're using urine or oral fluid. And then there's also two guidance documents. One is the model plan, which is a comprehensive drug-free workplace program the agencies can use to set out their plan. And most of the federal agencies that are required to have a plan do have a plan. So we follow those also. And then we do have guidance for scientific testing of designated positions. So a testing designated position is one that's essentially accepted by the federal agency. It's in a safety sensitive position. Therefore, that person can be tested, whether it's a random or post-accident or anything. All those positions too, as they're hired, are also tested under pre-employment testing.
I want to ask you about that in a bit also. What is a safety-sensitive position?
Okay. Well, I was just going to say a safety-sensitive position is really a position that, how do I say this specifically?
You don't want to crash the airplane.
Yeah, it's where a momentary lapse in any judgment in that position could really result in catastrophic consequences. And it really is an impact on public health, public safety, and also national security, because all top secret or above clearances require them to be a TDP or testing designated position.
Right. And I remember that being an area of discussion when I was at ONDCP, right? Or even working at ONDCP, everybody is considered a safety sensitive position, even if it's a desk job, because of their security clearance, right?
Correct.
And that was kind of, you know, debated and discussed, because I think we'd get list of employees and which one of these are really considered safety sensitive or not. That was a whole discussion. And that's how I got to meet you, which was one of my highlights at ONDCP, is when you came back and you showed us that executive order 12564. And here it was, President Reagan himself signed it and put ONDCP as a body overseeing the program, right? And that's how you came to educate us, because you were teaching us actually how to oversee that, and we met regularly regarding that.
We did. And you know, just to put it, I think from my perspective, is ONDCP, or also National Drug Control Policy, is sort of the policy side of who we discuss anything when it comes to the drug testing, the federal drug testing. We're sort of the regulatory side. So, you know, the policy, ONDCP would set a policy, and we would be required essentially to look at that as a regulatory. So that's how it's sort of looked at between ONDCP. We also, under the ICGEC, Executive Committee, that looks at that, we also have Department of Justice and Office of Personnel Management. So those four executive branch agencies sit on that committee, and that's where a lot of the decisions are made around policy part.
Right. And there are stories behind that, right? I mean, President Reagan signed this executive order and made it a law. Things were happening back in the 1980s that made government want to create these programs and drug testing. And one of the incidences I talked to our listeners about is the USS Nimitz. Were there other disasters that said, that's it, we got to have drug-free workplaces?
Yeah, the Nimitz was that was one in the military side that really, I guess, promoted the fact that we, you know, there's, when you use illicit substances, there is an impairment factor. I think the other one that really is recognized is the Chase train crash. And that's where they tested the driver of the train, and they were using marijuana at the time. And it was pretty catastrophic. You can't really, again, under our program, you can't really remediate that type of accident, not only for the lives that it lost, but also, you know, the destruction in property, personal property. So those are the two incidents really that I think stick out in history. And I did a timeline that looked at the timeline from 1986 when President Reagan signed executive order through. And there's you know, every certain amount of years, there's something that's major that does come up. Not saying necessarily an accident, was something that we try to move forward in making more significant as a federal program for testing.
That's important. I mean, each of these disasters is a teachable moment. We learn that in medicine. Any, you know, adverse event, we want to analyze it. We want to look at it, not to point fingers, but to learn and improve for the future. So we talked about the National Laboratory Certification Program, the drug-free workplace. And then we'll talk about learning about trends and what's happening. And you do that through the Drug Testing Advisory Board, right?
What we refer to as DTAB, the Drug Testing Advisory Board, have several different aspects. They look at the program as a whole. Meaning they look at the regulated drug testing side, they review parts of the program that looks at the emphasis or de-emphasis of certain parts. For instance, let's take an example, specimen validity testing. You know, a lot of people try to cheat essentially their drug test by substituting or adding adulteration product to their urine. So we may look at that. How do we overcome that? That's part of the Drug Testing Advisory Board. Essentially, the board has 10 members from a wide variety of backgrounds. There's responsible persons, which is what we call RPs at the HHS certified labs. So we have several of the RPs on the board. We have medical review officers on the board. We have psychiatrists and psychologists on the board that look at illicit substance use. So there's a number of, it's a very broad board is who we try to have, so we could talk about a lot of different things. Some of the other things is, you know, we may want to change the scope or mechanism of what we look at within the program. We just recently did a comprehensive review of the drug-free workplace program. So we did look at it, and we did what's called a SWOT analysis: strength, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So we looked at all of this within the comprehensive drug-free workplace program. And that's part of what my presentation at the last DTEP was, is these are some of the tasks or elements we want to work on to make it a better program. That's things that the DTAB also look at. And they also look at different, I guess, what I would say is probably the methods of substance use when it comes to that. What's an emerging issue that we need to be aware of? Maybe lowering the cutoffs and the mandatory guidelines. So there's a lot of things that we not only present to the public, but there is also what we can have as far as a closed session in DTAB, where there's a discussion of how we move in certain directions. I think it's a very, very important board. I give them a lot of credit on everything we discuss, the review of mandatory guidelines a lot of times, and then all the science and technical information that they bring to the board when it comes to that. The other part of the board, the last thing really within the board, is the board also has the ability to make a recommendation to the assistant secretary of SAMHSA in this case, which may go to the secretary himself for HHS. So the board is, in that sense, a body that's governed by the National Advisory Council, but in a sense, it's a very important program too, because we look at not only emerging issues, but the testing that we do right now.
I think that you got me to be the opening speaker for DTAB 1 year, and I sat there. That's where I take notes for the, yes, the 2 days of the conference. Really a highlight. I was very impressed.
I remember that well.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. Is the whole drug testing and drug-free workplace, I should have asked you this earlier, is that just for the federal workers? Is just Department of Transportation, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or does that go for any employer in the country? How's the overlap between public and private?
Right. The drug-free workplace program is really for federal executive branch agencies, but it extends out to a lot of the non-regulated sectors because we have several items online. We have the workplace toolkit. We have a number of things. We have a workplace helpline. So we try to reach out to the non-regulated drug testing sectors that want to create a drug testing program within the private entity, say the employer wants to create one. So although it's required within federal executive branch agencies to have a drug-free workplace program, which is really the gold standard we try to set in having a program, because there's many aspects to that program that President Reagan signed under EO 12564. And those are, you must have supervisor training, you have to have the drug testing side, donors are given notification of changes. So there's a number of things that the non-regulated sectors can follow also. DOT is a little bit different in the drug-free workplace program. Within Department of Transportation themselves, who are federal employees, they fall under the drug-free workplace program. But Department of Transportation regulates private entities, which is, like I said, trucking entities or pipeline or FAA, et cetera. So those fall under their own programs, but they're required to have a drug testing program in itself. So again, the public can use a lot of what we have designed and developed for federal agencies, but it would be under the non-regulated drug testing side. So that's how it sort of falls. Same under Nuclear Regulatory Commission, parts of Department of Defense for the civilian side. So it's very intermixed about with what we do under the regulated sector versus the non-regulated sectors.
So do private, trains, trucks, cars, agencies, Ubers, Lyfts, are they under the Department of Transportation, or those are private and separate?
A lot of those do fall under the Department of Transportation in the sense that they have to use the regulated drug testing sectors. And that's under 49 CFR Part 40 when it comes to Department of Transportation. We always talk about, you know, for instance, bus drivers or motor vehicle when it comes to trains and automobiles, the metros, all those do fall under the Department of Transportation when it comes to the regulated drug testing sector. But some of them, a lot of them, for instance, when you go to a state, they may use the mandatory guidelines for the testing or send all their samples to an HHS certified lab for testing. So it knows it's done under a quote regulated HHS certified lab that's regulated, but it may not be required. They may not be required as a private employer to fall under that. And then we have a lot of private employers that, for instance, it's a trucking company where the drivers fall under the FMCSA, which is 49 CFR Part 40. But say the administrative staff that may sit at the desk, they don't fall under that. So you do have a lot of private entities that are both sides, both non-regulated as well as regulated.
Interesting. That actually makes sense because you want that the person behind the wheel to be have a stricter or safer because they affect the public. And so at the DTAB is where I learned about the Federal Five. Tell us about the Federal Five.
So it always in the past, it's always been the Knight of Five. So, but basically it's now since then the division actually has moved from NIDA, National Institute of Drug Abuse, into SAMHSA, where we now sit under the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention under SAMHSA, which sits under HHS. But in that Knight of Five, as it used to be called, it's now really the federally regulated five. There's actually more like 10. There's amphetamines, which includes amphetamine, methamphetamine. We also include MDMA or ecstasy and MDA, the metabolite of ecstasy. So those are two, or that's a class, the amphetamines in general that we test. There's cocaine, which is really what's called benzylecanine, which is the metabolite of cocaine. There's marijuana or THC, or what is in our program, the scientific side is Delta 9 THCA, which is the metabolite in the urine sample. And then there are all the opiates, which include morphine and codeine. They also include the synthetic opioids, which is oxycodone, oxymorphone, hydrocodone, and hydromorphone. And then we also have the class for PCP or pencyclidine. So all of these are the regulated drug testing sector, the analytes that we test in the program. We also, if I can say here, we've also recommended that fentanyl be added to the panel under the opiates assay so that we can look at fentanyl in general across the board. And what one of the things that's different, which I think is important to mention in the federal program side, is on a case-by-case basis, if a federal agency wants to test, for instance, a Schedule I or Schedule II drug, they can petition HHS, which is basically our division, to test that analyte. So we do allow, on a case-by-case basis, the testing of really any Schedule I or Schedule II drug.
What do you mean by allow? If they want to go beyond, like we want to...
Right. If they want to go beyond the standard, as I mentioned, the standard five that I just mentioned, if they want to go beyond, and let's say they want to test methadone, you know, which is I believe it's a Schedule II, they would petition us to ask under this certain part, maybe it's reasonable suspicion test. Under this test, on a case by case, they would petition to test for this analyte. And we would look at the information that was provided to us, and then we would decide if we would allow them to test this sample for that analyte. And it's important sometimes because under reasonable suspicion testing, if you obviously know that person's impaired, in a sense, that they may come back totally negative for all drugs, but there was obviously something causing impairment part under that reasonable suspicion test.
All right. So I'm a little confused. Does that mean, but we usually see so many other tests, like you were saying, 10, we see benzodiazepines and many more than the federal five when you do these testing. Do they, each of those, they had to petition and ask to add these other things?
No, actually, and I'm glad you asked that because I think that's important. So under Executive Order 12564 in public law, we're only allowed to test for Schedule 1 and Schedule 2. The benzodiazepines, the BARBs, the other drugs, propoxyphene, et cetera, which are tested in the non-regulated sector, they are outside of the Schedule 1 and 2. Therefore, in the federal program, we're not allowed to test anything that's not a Schedule 1 or Schedule 2. So that, in that sense, in the non-regulated sectors, they are allowed to test that, but not in the regulated sector.
Interesting, because all those things are additive, right? The opioid and the benzodiazepines, and you definitely see that.
Yeah, I know you touched, when you were at ONDCP, we touched on tramadol as one of those. Yeah. And so, though we could test tramadol because of scheduling, it isn't part of the required panel, you know, right now for that testing.
You have a great memory. You remember that. all right. So, but learning from you, I advocated after I left ONDCP, advocated for the federal six. And I learned way back then, that was, what was it, like 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
You were already seeing trends of fentanyl before this, you know, this logarithmic, you know, deadly wave of fentanyl has hit our country. From that, I started advocating for the federal six, adding fentanyl, because fentanyl is an opioid, but it's synthetic and it doesn't show up on the regular opiate screen that you were mentioning. Same as tramadol, because I was making the case for that too. And I learned that it really costs only 75 cents to add that on a regular hospital lab. So it wasn't cost prohibitive. And we got laws passed in California, and now several other states and many other places are doing that as well. So I learned it from you, but now I'm wondering if, and we passed it in several states, but I guess federal government moves a little slower, right? You don't have that.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the recommendation has been made to add fentanyl to the analyte table, and that is to test of all samples. And we would add that under the analyte table under the mandatory guidelines, and then DOT would then provide a notice for public rulemaking to also add fentanyl. So it would be a secondary part of that. Same with NRC, same with any other agency. I do have to say, and I apologize that, you know, when we discussed it years and years ago, we had started moving in this direction to add fentanyl, and we knew it was a problem. We could see that. We started doing some pulse testing, some positivity within the regulated drug testing sector on the negative samples, and we were aware that fentanyl was increasing. Under the regulatory rules, though, you have to, one, provide a proposed revision to the guideline that goes out for public comment. It comes back. You answer all those public comments. Then you send it back out as a final version with an implementation date. That took quite a long time since we were changing the analyte table to be more flexible so we could add and remove analytes on an annual basis. Because right now, for instance, as an example, which isn't a very good example, but it took about 4 years to get MDMA added to the analyte table. So again, if you have an emerging issue at the time, 4 years is way beyond the time that it should take to get something on the panel.
Right. So by that time, it's not important anymore.
Right. So we made that recommendation to make the panel much more flexible to add it on an annual basis where we would just go through OMB, Office of Management Budget, to add this, and it would be on an annual basis. DOT was on board with this. And so finally, in 2024, which is this year in March, or February and March, we added the analyte table can be changed on an annual basis. So that is the proposed change now with the recommendation to add fentanyl to the analyte table. So it has taken several years to get to that point under regulatory rules, but we're finally at that point.
Right. All right. And then, so when will this, what's the next steps? When will it be approved, or is it approved?
Well, right now, currently, I can say that the recommendation has been made. It's being reviewed. It's in the process of review at HHS. So with that, just as I lay out in the public under the process, is from that point, it will go to OMB for final approval, Office of Management Budget. Then we will set an implementation date. If approved, to add fentanyl, then we would set an implementation date that all the HHS certified laboratories would start to test for fentanyl. DOT would follow suit with a revision to the NPRM on 49 CFR Part 40 to add fentanyl, or follow HHS analyte table. And from that point, they would set an implementation date. We did this with the synthetic opioids, so the oxycodones, et cetera. And we instituted testing in federal agencies prior to DOT. We would do the same thing with fentanyl. We would institute the testing of fentanyl in the federal agencies with DOT to follow.
All right. And okay, so now you actually have a comparison. During the opioid prescription epidemic, how long did it take you to add the oxycodones to the regular opioids? And for our listeners, the regular opiate panel is just, you know, morphine, heroin, and adding oxycodone is also a synthetic opioid. So that required, that's a different test, actually.
Right.
So how long, just to compare, let's compare oxycodone versus fentanyl. How long did it take you to get oxycodone added, and how long is it taking to take fentanyl? Although it's not exactly a fair question, because you're actually doing a lot more. You want to create flexibility in your guidelines.
All right. Thanks for the question. You know, I think with that, at the time, it took us about 2 years to add the synthetic opiates to the drug testing panel. And because of that addition, and there was at the time, obviously, an emerging issue around the synthetic opioid use. And so we looked at that. We looked at prescription, the actual prescriptions that were being elevated under FDA's data. And we knew that there was an opiate epidemic starting. So it didn't take as long. DOT followed about a year after we had required the testing under the mandatory guidelines. So that took about a year. But again, there wasn't a change that we had to make on the analyte table. And that really is what took quite a while, is to get that revision in place under the mandatory guidelines so that we can look at analytes on an annual basis. So again, as a comparison, you know, to actually add fentanyl, it's taken several years. To add the opiates, it took a couple years to add those. But again, going forward, we hope that as we come across emerging issues or new drugs, and that can be the addition or removal of a drug from the analyte table, is we'll be able to do that on an annual basis. So we'll be much more, let's say, flexible. When it comes to that, we'll open it up for the Drug Testing Advisory Board. We'll have public comment during that advisory board meeting, as well as they can submit comments from the public on the analyte proposal or the recommendations to add or remove analytes to the table.
Right. And I'm impressed, you know, it sounds very limiting. You have only able to test for these, you know, few drugs, Schedule 1 and 2, and yet you have these huge databases. And back then, you know, probably 10 years ago, you were still able to see fentanyl. And I remember Department of Defense was including fentanyl and a whole slew of drugs before. Is like their pre-employment before joining the military. You kind of have to pass this very comprehensive, more than scheduled one and two drug tests. And I was surprised that people wanting to go into the military were testing positive for fentanyl.
Yeah, and the military is essentially when they can change their regulatory roles within the testing, they're much more agile, I would say, than we are, because we're required to go out for public comment. Again, and other federal agencies, meaning Department of Transportation, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, also have to go out and revise. So public comment really applies to all regulated testing when we go out for public comment in the mandatory guidelines. So we're a lot less inflexible or a lot more inflexible to make the changes without public comment, which takes a length of time in the process, whereas Department of Defense can change an analyte or a pulse test that they can look at and do pulse testing. For instance, they'll pulse test, say, 40% of all the samples that come.
Tell us what a pulse test is.
So a pulse test is if you have an emerging issue. So let's, for instance, the cannabinoids that came out, the synthetic cannabinoids, they knew it was an issue. They started to see it. So what I'm referring to as pulse testing is, for instance, Department of Defense would say, okay, let's look at the synthetic cannabinoids in every in 40% of the samples that come in. We'll see if we have an issue, an emerging issue for this drug. So they're able to pulse test and see if they actually have an issue with a certain drug, be that fentanyl or the synthetic cannabinoids or whatever it may be. We can't really do that as far as doing any type of pulse testing in that sense, because these are regulated samples. They're only required to be tested for these amounts or this certain part of the drug. So again, DOD has more flexibility to add and remove drugs on a quicker basis than we do in the regulated sectors.
Fascinating. So is that the only agency that gives you the emerging trends?
No, we look at a number of databases. We look at, for instance, Office of National Drug Control, what they look at, NIDA, CDC, State Department, DEA, which is very interesting database. And we also do some of our own testing on a non-regulated drug testing to see if there's any emerging issues. We like to do that because, again, as we look at being able to be more flexible with the analyte table change, we want to know well in advance that we have an emerging issue so that we can make the recommendation to add or remove drugs from the panel. So we look at a number of different databases when it comes to what they're seeing, both biological samples that are from humans as well as non-biological when it comes to samples, for instance, under a DEA raid, what samples they may get, they recover in a warehouse. You know, what is the drug that they may get? So we try to follow all of those. And also the Drug Testing Advisory Board is brought in on a lot of this information that we get under the NLCP contract, is be able to look at these. And then we'll bring it in to the Drug Testing Advisory Board, have the discussion, look and see if it warrants, does it meet certain things? Is it an impairing substance? Is there deaths associated with this drug? There's a number of things that we want to look at regarding that. Xylazine being one of those recently that are being looked at but again, xylazine is mostly a cutting agent, is my understanding. So it's usually when you look at a cutting agent, it's going to have some other drug that we test that will be positive.
Right. So there's almost never, almost, not 100%, positive xylazine without fentanyl. Although there have been, it's a case report, not a trend of just xylazine. So that's interesting. I think that is the most important thing, because it keeps you ahead of knowing what's there. And as a physician, very much is relevant to our clinical practice, because We do not have the capability of doing this. I remember when I learned that Department of Defense is testing for fentanyl, like, what? Really? How do you do that? And how are you? And they were just testing for, again, the synthetic cannabinoids, the spice and K2s when that spice, first yeah, came out. And it's like, how are you able to, first of all, how are you able to do that? Because I can't do that in the hospital. And two, really, there are people in the military who do that? That was like two surprising things, but very relevant, so we could see, so we could know what's going on. Otherwise, we would have no idea. We cannot test GHB. I remember there's many drugs that we cannot test for in the hospital. We changed that with fentanyl. But you're seeing that. Tell us, like, what are the current trends? What happened? Let's start with fentanyl. What are you seeing with fentanyl? And this is probably the biggest N, right, of anything in the country. How many out of how many specimens are you looking at?
Yeah, some of the data that I presented at the Drug Testing Advisory Board meeting a little over a month ago, is it showed some of the trends. This was specifically from CRL Laboratories, but they do non-regulated testing of fentanyl, norfentanyl, which is a metabolite of fentanyl, in urine and oral fluid, or in urine. This data was just really around urine. But the positivity rate, and I'll just read some of these because I think this is really interesting data. From 2020 in quarter four, the positivity rate was about 0.5. In Q4 of 2023, the positivity rate was 1.6. So it's basically been a straight line up in the regulated drug testing sectors around fentanyl use, or the non-regulated that they're testing of what they're seeing. So to put that in perspective, the fentanyl positives are actually higher than cocaine and all the others, except for marijuana and amphetamines. So it's, again, fentanyl as a whole, for that testing is actually much higher than any of the half of the analytes that we test, even the synthetic opioids.
And these are, like, I don't know, out of like millions of samples of people who are going through employment physicals or random testing, or
most of it's pre-employment, some of it's random. So it depends on if an employer wants to also test for fentanyl. So that's where this data comes on in the non-regulated sectors that are currently testing for fentanyl, which they have been for really probably the last 2 years. They've been testing in the non-regulated sectors for fentanyl, adding it to the panel.
Right. So that's high trend for fentanyl. Same from, you said, you know, more than cocaine and marijuana, is that going up?
So some of the other ones that are concerning that I'll just talk about briefly here is there's a lot of isomers of marijuana. And when I say isomers, they basically change the chemistry of the compound to add a double bond here, remove one here, etc. But in that, it changes essentially the potential, or in some cases, it changes actually the impairment part, so how psychoactive it is. For instance, Delta 8 THC, we test specifically for Delta 9 THC around marijuana. There's Delta 8 THC, there's Delta 10 THC, there's THCO, there's THCP. There's all kinds of different isomers now that are being, I guess, created in a sense, that are out there, but we do, in the regulated drug testing sector, we only look for the Delta 9. So there's those trends that we're able to see, but we don't report any of those, obviously, as positive, and they're not tested under the regulated drug testing sectors.
Interesting. And we talked about that some places like New York had eliminated THC from their panel. Did that reduce your thing? First of all, how are they allowed to do that if that's the part of the federal five? Is it because they're private or not? They're not federal employees? And that's the first question. And then did that change your data?
No, actually, for the federal agency testing, the regulated drug testing sector, it did not change because federal government basically trumps the state laws. So, for instance, as you mentioned, in New York, they've been able to institute legal proceedings under employee protections. And so with that, the private employers, not in the regulated drug testing sectors, but the private employers that had drug testing in for their employees, they are currently moving to where they're not testing, for instance, with pre-employment, they're not testing for marijuana. So under the drug testing index from Quest, which was also some of the presentation from Dr. Barry Sample given at DTAP, is it has reduced the rate of drug testing by about 12% for THC, which is pretty significant. If you have, you know, if you have a million samples that are testing for THC under pre-employment, but now you're only testing 800,000 of them, well, that's pretty significant, the amount of people that are not being tested. But as these laws are implemented, which I don't know the exact date that the law in New York will be implemented, but after that point, it will require that no employer be able to test for pre-employment, pre-employment testing for marijuana. So that will actually, you know, totally eliminate the testing for marijuana in that state. But it does not affect the federal government testing if there's federal employees in that state or under Department of Transportation or Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Those all stay in place because that's federal testing.
Very interesting. I think that explains, I had a discussion with an executive of a hospital who was telling me that these new doctors coming in to work at the hospital were failing their open book test, right? Their employment and testing positive for marijuana. And their solution to that was just to get rid of the test, which is interesting. If they
there's been a lot of discussions, for instance, around that, is if you're in a safety sensitive position of a private employer, let's say a physician or a nurse or a crane operator or EMTs, these are all ones that were mentioned in this. If you're in that position where it's a public health concern, should those individuals still be tested for marijuana? And right now, there's some states that do require or continue to require the testing for marijuana in those positions, which are, in my view, safety sensitive positions. But there's no exact determination of what is or what should be a safety sensitive position that's always tested. So that's something that maybe the federal government needs to work on.
Right. Because I haven't, you know, in my experience, I don't think physicians and nurses are considered safety sensitive, but maybe they should be.
Right.
What about?
You're correct. In some states, they're not. And then in other states, there's mentioned. I do not believe that nurses was one of those mentions is a safety sensitive position, though. But again, in my concern for that is, you know, nurses are still giving drugs, et cetera, to patients. So it still should be considered, I believe, a safety sensitive position.
Right. What about other trends? Like we're seeing legalizations of magic mushroom psilocybin. Are you seeing that? Is that on your radar?
Yeah, I think some of the things that obviously the things that we do look at is around the psychoactive drugs or substances. Are they Schedule I or Schedule II? That's an important thing. Are they something that we look at on a regular basis? We've included it in some of the pulse testing around the non-negative or the non-regulated drug test. So we are looking at those, ketamine being one, et cetera. But do they play a role in the federal testing? We're not really sure. I know there's a number of applications, I believe they're INDs, investigational new drugs, that have gone to FDA looking at MDMA or psilocybin or ketamine in that case of using it for PTSD. So I think there's a number of things that are, you know, as far as can be used clinically, that FDA is reviewing right now.
But I don't know if you want your pilot to be on these mushrooms or ketamine while they're flying the plane, right?
Right. And I will say, just to jump back a little bit, for our agency, for the federal executive branch agencies, in the mandatory guideline, we can test on a case-by-case basis. So if a federal agency came to us and said this was a reasonable suspicion test, you know, can you test for this analyte? We would be able to look at that and the information as to why we would test for that analyte and test for that. DOD doesn't necessarily have the same authority for that, but they really follow the mandatory guidelines in the analyte table, whereas we can essentially choose on a case-by-case basis to look at other Schedule I and Schedule II drugs.
Right. So is this a loophole now? So think about the pilots and the bus drivers or whatever. They could be using ketamine and psilocybins and mushrooms and these other things that are not on the test and be impaired and you wouldn't know?
Well, I don't think so. And I wouldn't want to say that it was, because, for instance, under FAA rules, they're tested for a number of other analytes that wouldn't be necessary. So they sort of, FAA has their own rules and regulations on certain things. Like, for instance, if it's a prescription oxycodone tablet, you can't fly for a length of time after you take that. If it's a prescription, if it was prescribed by a physician. So they do have their own rules to look at different things like that. So I don't think there's really any reason or concern around that. And again, but under the agencies themselves, the modes, and I don't want to talk for DOT, but what could they test? I mean, they might be able to look at some of those if there is a reasonable suspicion test.
Right.
You know, under the federal agencies, for instance, if it's a federal employee, then they could be looked at as far as Schedule I or Schedule II drugs.
Now, the test is just part of the picture, right? If you test positive for ketamine, but you're being treated for depression and you have a physician giving you the ketamine, it's not like, okay, you're positive, you're out of the job, right? There's a lot more to the drug test.
Yeah, there's a lot more to that. We have in our program specifically, as well as Department of Transportation, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, within those programs, they have what's called a medical review officer. That's a physician that looks at a drug test, reaches out to the donor, discusses as to why a drug test would have been positive, sees if that individual would have a prescription for that medication from their primary physician. So there's a lot of rules and regulations when it comes to that, as far as a medical review officer determining, was it a valid prescription? Was that prescription being used accordingly to the prescription? And does it cause any type of impairment issue in the position that the person is being tested? So that's what the MRO's authority is to do, and we've instituted that. We also regulate the entities that are MRO training entities, as well as giving the test to MROs every 4 years, or 3 to 5, I should say, 3 to 5 years. They have to, they're required to take another test from a training facility or training entity for MROs. So all of that information is reviewed by a medical review officer or a physician to make sure the donor, and those three things I just mentioned, is looked at. Was it a valid prescription? Amphetamine, methamphetamine is being taken, Adderall, you know, if you're taking codeine or morphine, all of those, again, are being looked at. It's pretty unlikely if you have a cocaine positive that would be by prescription. So, you know, there are nasal swabs that, you know, they use for nasal surgery that do have cocaine. So there could be some reasons as to why you would be positive for a certain drug. But again, these are all reviewed by medical officers and looked at as far as valid prescriptions of what that person has. And I should say, to end that, is if it is a valid prescription, there's two options. It's a negative based on the MRO's review of that, or it could be a safety sensitive situation where the person is asked to step down from that position while they're on this medication. So there are a number of things that a medical review officer can do to make sure the person stays safe as well as the public around them.
That makes sense. You don't want to be impaired, whether it's from an illegal substance or even a prescription. Medications can cause impairment. What about false positives? I have to tell you, my daughters are in the Navy, and I've bought like the everything bagel forever. And now they won't eat them because they're afraid of the poppy seeds and they don't want to have a false positive test because they have some horror story of somebody in the military who ate some poppy seeds and had to, you know, go through hell to prove that it was just from their bagel. I don't know if that story is true, but what about the false negatives?
Well, it is interesting because poppy seeds do contain a large, in some cases, they can contain large amounts of morphine or codeine. We just learned recently that there are poppy seeds now that are being designed for pharmaceuticals to have high levels of morphine or high levels of codeine. So with that, in the United States, the FDA oversees essentially the washing of poppy seeds before they're put into the market or put onto the bagel or sent to a shopping center, et cetera, to be sold as a pound or a half a pound of poppy seeds that you can use in your cooking. But with that, we do have some concern about the amounts of morphine and codeine and how much is actually eaten. We did revise the mandatory guidelines recently. The implementation was in February. We've changed the cutoff for codeine and morphine. Essentially, the morphine cutoff we moved to 4,000. The codeine cutoff we left at 2,000. But there have been instances where you see large amounts of codeine with very little, if no, morphine, which really should raise a red flag to a medical review officer, because being the fact that if you're going to see codeine, you should be seeing morphine, or at least at some level that's representative of the amount of codeine. So in this, I know it's been looked at as far as these poppy seeds that are being sold that are coming in from other countries right now, with these higher levels of morphine and codeine. So I don't think it's unwarranted to look at these or be concerned. But again, in the revisions of the guidelines, we looked at all scientific papers for the last 6 years around the testing of opioids when it comes to the actual bagels or poppy seeds that are used on these. And we did not see any results except for one, that the person was higher than 4,000 for morphine. So for that reason, the medical review officers were looking at concentrations between 4,000 and 15,000 and making a determination if it was a poppy seed. It really shouldn't be a determination if it was a poppy seed if now it's above 4,000. It really can't come from poppy seeds. So I say that because that was newly instituted in the federal agencies, but has not been instituted as far as the testing and the cutoff change in the Department of Transportation. So, yeah, so it's always interesting when you look at the determinations, especially around the poppy seeds, because, again, under FDA's rule, the way they're washed, it washes out most of the codeine and morphine in the seed itself. But with these new developed hybrid seeds, I think we're seeing more codeine and or more morphine in the seeds.
All right. But my daughter could probably safely eat everything bagel from Einstein's or something.
Yeah, I think she would be fine. I think it's when you're consuming large amounts of seeds. Or I will say, if you're consuming large amounts of seeds on a daily basis. You eat a bagel every morning that has a large amount of seeds. We have to look at, is there any cumulative effect of that morphine or codeine?
Interesting. What about, so that's false positives. What about cheating? And you mentioned that there's various adulterants. You could buy fake urine. I had a patient one time when the lab called me and it said, this is just water. And they knew right away, this is not urine, this is water. any creative cheating mechanisms?
There's a lot of creative cheating mechanisms for it. How they do that, I don't know sometimes. But as you had mentioned, which I think is really important, is when you're under a direct observe collection, it's much harder, obviously, to cheat, to put in a substituted specimen or put in an adulteration product in your urine. And in the federal testing, we actually test for all what's called SVT, specimen validity testing. We test for a number of different substances around this, what they would adulterate the sample with. And we also look at pH of urine. We look at the creatinine concentration for dilute samples, and we also look at specific gravity. Those are just some of the initial tests that put them in a category where they can be substituted or adulterated. But yes, the one difficult thing in our program that's been very difficult to overcome is the synthetic urines. Synthetic urine can be a regular urine given to the person from a spouse, and it's a negative urine. It's just substituted. So at the collection site, when the collection is done, is the collector has to check for the temperature. So temperature is key, and a person would have to keep that at body temperature so that it wouldn't record as a low temperature or a high temperature in some situations where they actually have heaters that they use in the synthetic urines that they substitute. So there's a number of ways, a number of things that we're looking at of how to determine a little bit better that it's a biological sample, not necessarily it's being adulterated or substituted, but was it a biological sample to begin with? For instance, both in male and female, you have testosterone metabolites, different being in male or female, but if you don't see those metabolites in the urine sample, for instance, then it's probably not a biological sample.
And wow.
Again, if anyone That's wants fascinating. To go back and look at the information, we had a great presentation on adulteration products as well as substitution and looking at unique metabolites around SVT testing. And that is on our website under our detail.
Wow. That's very interesting.
Yeah. So a lot of stuff goes on there that we're looking at. But again, it's very concerning because obviously all these positions are safety sensitive that are being tested. And when they're cheating a drug test, that leaves a safety sensitive position that it isn't really being looked at like it should be if they're able to cheat the drug test.
Right. Right. And that, and somebody who does that, right, I don't know that, you know, do you really want them in that
and
job?
Again, I would say that if it's a fail, if for instance, a person goes in and they fail to give a sample, then again, that almost has more weight than a positive because in a positive, you would go into, in most agencies, they have EAP services or rehab programs, et cetera. Whereas if you fail, because you couldn't give a sample or didn't want to give a sample, then that actually carries more weight, which in sometimes would require administrative action on that. And that would be up to firing the employee.
And I'm glad you pointed that out because I do notice, and as years go by, there's a lot more understanding for the disease of a substance use disorder and right. treatment. Not just firing of employees, it's catching a problem. Another deterrence, also detection for, you know, like getting your blood sugar checked and now it's high, we're going to have to treat your diabetes, you know, you're testing positive, you may have a substance use disorder and we need to treat that. So I think there's a lot more compassion to that and understanding of that.
Yeah, and that's why I say we're a prevention program, because and able to identify substance use, the person can therefore get treatment. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean they have to be fired, but they can get treatment then.
Right. So I left the controversy stuff for last. And when I was in ONDCP, marijuana was the M word. At the end, it was an election year. It was very sensitive. You can't bring that up. We're kind of in the same position now. It's an election year, a contested issue. But I just want to tell us, leaving the politics aside, and I know that you're restricted as to what you can say, what you can't, understanding that. One of the hot issues, I'd be, if I didn't ask you, it'd be kind of awkward. But rescheduling of marijuana is a big debated subject. What you as a federal employee and Representative Samson, what can you tell us about that effort?
Well, again, thank you for asking, because I think it is on everybody's mind. But as it is with our rules and regulations, we're required to follow certain rules and processes. And that's, if it's being reviewed or public comment or going to OMB, et cetera. So I think the rescheduling of any controlled substance follows a procedure that's really set forth by the statute that requires the public an opportunity to comment. That's where currently the NPRM is right now. And that's to comment on the possibility. It's also not necessarily required, but you can also have an administration hearing. And that's where, DEA could have an administrative hearing to hear more public comments on this issue. So again, during this time for us, is marijuana remains a Schedule I drug. Therefore, we would continue to test for under pre-employment, random, whatever it may be, we would continue to test for marijuana. If there were to be a change, all I can really say is, the Department of Transportation, Nuclear Regulatory, Department of Defense, we would all look at this and decide as a regulatory role as to what would happen.
So if it comes off Schedule 1 into Schedule 3, it automatically falls off the Federal 5.
Correct?
I can't say that definitively. Because we all have different testing authorities. And all I can say is when you look at impairing substances, when it comes to safety sensitive issues under DOT, it may be different than it is for us because we fall under executive order and also public law. So we can or authorized to test for Schedule I, Schedule II. But again, if it's changed, then that may be different, but I think it's being looked at right now. So I can't definitively say anything about that, whether that would change anything or not when it comes to, and again, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, for instance, is a fitness for duty program. They have different authority than we do, the same as DOT has different authority than HHS.
Interesting. Now, you also testified on the federal response to marijuana legalization for transportation policy. I know that was kind of in your bio. Can you tell us about that? What did you testify at?
It was very scary. No, I'm just kidding.
It sounds scary.
I testified, and again, this was years ago, way before this part that we're discussing now around the NPRM. But I testified on the Committee of Oversight and Government Reform. It was the subcommittee on government operations. And specifically, it was in front of Congress. There was a number of questions asked to myself. Department of Transportation was there. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration was there. So it was basically a panel. And that panel really was looking at around the issue of marijuana, the impairment side, et cetera. And those were sort of the questions that followed when it came from the congressional committee that were asking the questions is what do we see in the data? What does the data show? What does the federal program do? So there's a number of questions to look at that as far as the safety issue around driving, and this was specifically around driving, but obviously driving impacts Department of Transportation. It impacts the NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And in a lot of cases, it also impacts HHS, because under our authority, we also, for instance, not only look at drivers that are moving goods here and there within federal agencies, but also like air traffic controllers that work under HHS or work under FAA or Department of Defense. So it was looked at as a whole, but again, that occurred 6-7 years ago. I don't know the exact date of when I testified. But again, it was looking at the impairment part of marijuana and around driving.
Interesting. And back then, they probably wasn't the proliferation of these very high potency products that are being sold now, right? You know, these 98% THC products, et cetera. And I'm wondering...
That's also an interesting thing you say that, because I think it's important. You know, when it comes to potency, for instance, I was mentioning Delta 8. So a Delta 8 is about 60% as potent as Delta 9. But what the sellers or the people that are producing these products do is, instead of having a 10 milligram dose to be a 10 milligram dose of THC, they may have a 15 milligram dose. So the potency is relatively the same between the Delta 8 and the Delta 9. They're just putting more in it in the Delta 8 products, or Delta 10, or whatever that may be.
Right. And the other thing, if we're talking about the Delta products, the 8s and the 10s and the O's and the P's, is that these are made in a lab. They sell as hemp products, but they're not from a plant. They're synthetic.
Right. I agree with you on that. I think at the potency levels, it's very difficult to get to those levels in a biological sample when it comes to a plant. You know, hemp plants contain small amounts of Delta 8, but at the levels that you see in some of these products, I don't know how they could concentrate it that concentrated from a plant.
And when you're doing the testing for random testing or for cause, are these just qualitative plus minus, or do you actually have numbers? And can you tell from the numbers if, like, wow, you were like vaping, you know, 90% THC oil? This is not just a simple, you know, joint.
So in our program, we have a two-step process. The sample is initially screened using a screening methodology that identifies that as a positive. From that, an aliquot is taken from the sample that they have. That aliquot then goes to what is called confirmation. From confirmation, that is identified. You put that sample through an extraction process. It's pretty lengthy. In most of the instances, it goes on to most of the laboratories that we use or HHS certified use, for instance, GCMS or gas chromatography mass spectrometry to identify it. So they look at very specific ions within that sample, and it's 99.999% sure that they're identifying the exact ion that makes it positive, for instance, for cocaine or benzyl echinate. So at that level, when we have confirmation levels, or what we call cutoffs, so if it's above the cutoff of a sample that makes it positive, then that is reported positive and goes to the medical review officer to make the determination. I say that because we're a deterrence program, and a lot of times we've looked at different levels, and if you are a zero tolerance program, you can go down much, much lower and look at, for instance, cocaine and see that there is still benzyl echinine in the sample, but it didn't meet the cutoff. So therefore, it's negative, even though it may contain some analyte around the benzyl ecodine. So that's sort of the two-tier process that happens in every HHS-certified lab. And that's where we also send proficiency testing samples to provide evidence that they're testing accordingly to the rules, as well as they're making sure that it's the cutoffs are set, et cetera.
I'm wondering, and I don't, maybe you've never looked at it, but we know from the products being sold that the potency has gone up a lot. I'm wondering if that correlates to drug testing, the you know, nanograms per milliliter numbers overall has gone up into what you're finding in your positive samples.
That's a good question. We get from the laboratories, the HHS certified laboratories, it's called a non-negative specimen list. And we look at that to not only pick out the samples that we're going to look at during the inspections, but that is a good question. Have we actually seen the levels go up as potency has gone up? And specifically, obviously, if we're looking at marijuana, et cetera, cocaine. We did do a little bit of a study. We looked at some of the samples that were considered negative. But when you lower the cutoff, for instance, with benzyl ecodine from, say, 100 down to 50 or down to 10, you're picking up about six times more samples when you're looking at those cocaine cutoffs. So I don't know. Very good question. Something that I will look at, because I'm not sure if looking at the data, it might be able to tell us if that potency levels have gone up on a lot of the drugs.
Yeah, and what else can you tell us data wise as far as THC and impairment? Are there more overall positive?
Well, I don't necessarily want to just focus on THC, but I did have some interesting information, and this comes from Dr. Berry's sample that we looked at it specifically for the Drug Testing Advisory Board. But he sent me some, and this is public knowledge, so I'm not saying anything that's not, but I have some data in front of me. And what we looked at was pre-employment testing on post-accident versus post-accident testing for drugs. And it's for instance, in pre-employment testing for marijuana itself, we had a pre-employment positivity rate of 1.2%. But when you look at post-accident testing for the same analyte in 2023, it's 2.2%. So that's almost an 84% difference, higher difference in post-accident testing than it is in pre-employment. And as you stated earlier, it's interesting because in pre-employment, can you study for that test? So they know, but in post-accident, you don't necessarily get a chance to study for that test because the collection of the sample is done right then. If you look at, for instance, if you look at cocaine, let me see if this is for cocaine. For pre-employment in 2023 was 0.21%. In post-accident, it was 0.71%. That's 238.1% difference. So my guess is from the data that we look at is under post-accident testing, there's a significant increase in positivity rates versus pre-employment rates.
Right. And that's why President Reagan, when he started all this, said that this is a safety measure, and the data kind of shows that.
Public health, public safety, all of that around. And that's why the Nimitz was so critical when that accident happened with the jets and killing, I think it was 7 or 8 crewmen because of marijuana use in that case.
Yeah. And so what's the conclusion? What do you want everyone to know about your division of workplace programs?
Well, hopefully I explained it well enough that everybody has an understanding of the division now and the regulated drug testing sector. It's very complicated. I get questions that, being there from 2012 as the director, I still get questions that's very hard to answer. But we do regulate the HHS certified labs. I think that's very important. So any test that you send to an HHS certified lab is done in a basically a regulated drug testing way, which is very prescriptive as to how they do that. We have medical review officers that oversee all of the results that come out of the HHS certified labs, which I think is really important when it comes to prescription medications, et cetera, or medicines in general, as to what could, if it were to be a false positive, which it wouldn't be in our program, but what would make that false positive a false positive. In the federal agencies, we have contact people called drug program coordinators. They're specifically the ones that interact with the HHS certified labs when it comes to that, as far as the testing, who's tested, what the testing does in your position. I think that's very important. And then we've revised a lot of the guidance documents in 2023, and we had a comprehensive review of all the program, which I think is very critical. And then, and that's part of that. We also, last year, we started a drug-free workplace program supervisors training course. It's on our website, but anyone can go onto our website, download that training course, and it tells you a lot about the drug testing program in general and what to look for, et cetera. So I think that's really important. We also have FAQs on our website around workplace drug testing. And as I mentioned earlier, we have a drug-free workplace helpline. So any consumer can call in, and the person that oversees this, very knowledgeable. He was one of our certifying scientists and chemist within the division. He's since retired, but he oversees that helpline. You can get pretty much any question you want around drug testing answered through that. And then we have the workplace toolkit, which really helps employers set up a program around drug testing, whether it be federally regulated or not. So that's also an important part of the website. And those are really the things that I wanted to emphasize at the end that I think is important in our division.
That's a lot. We're going to have that in our show notes, samhsa.gov/workplace. It's in the show notes. A lot of information. And as long as we've been talking, there's more. Like, I didn't even ask you to go down the whole oral fluid situation. And that's kind of how we met, too. When that was coming about. But this has been very enlightening. I'm always learning something new. Thank you so much, Ron, for taking the time. And always easy to get, you know, a federal employee to talk about such sensitive information. And I really appreciate the effort also of the agency for allowing you to come in and chat with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more high truths.